They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Joining us on the Commons today, I am very pleased to have David Kahn from Houston, Texas. David is an attorney and one of the few attorneys out there who actually represents homeowners and is always concerned about what's going on. So he's active legislatively, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about what they did this year and where it ended up and what's going on in Texas. So, David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and join us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm always happy to talk to you, David. So what's going on? I know you had a bill in, and I don't think it went anywhere, did it?
Well, if you're asking whether the bill passed, the answer is no. If you're asking whether we feel we made progress, the answer is we do feel that we made progress.
Good.
This was a very hard year in the Texas legislature to get anything done, and of some interest, virtually nothing happened with respect to homeowners associations. Now, the difficulties with the legislature had to do with quite a number of other issues that Texas is grappling with, ranging from funding for the education system and health care to bathroom bills and the question of who regulates the planting of trees, and a whole bunch of other issues that you would think grown-ups could resolve, but has not yet happened. I'm going to stay away from all of those issues, as I did during the session, but what we felt this year, as you may recall, last year, we had, two years ago, the Texas legislature meets every 2 years. And 2 years ago, we felt we ended up with a good session, although it was hard fought. And this year, we decided to take on the most important issue for folks in what I call single-family subdivisions, as distinguished from condos. It's probably also the most important issue for people in condos, but it's clearly the most important issue for people in subdivisions. And that is the ability of homeowner associations and the lawyers they work with, almost always in collaboration with management companies as well, to impose extraordinary fees against homeowners for which they extract payments, literally putting their hands in the homeowners' wallets. And they do this under the guise of attorney fees, collection costs, crazy charges, and sham negotiations. And the leverage that they get is a combination of the attorney fees that they threaten to collect. In Texas, there's the potential to impose a $200 a day penalty, and the ability to foreclose on a homestead. So what we wanted to do was to directly address that center of power for the associations who work in collaboration with their lawyers. And so that was our focus. Other people had other important issues to raise as well. None of them got passed, but the other important issues included what should have been a no-brainer, that is, the right of a homeowner to have a religious symbol in their front yard. Most commonly, what people want to do is put up a small cross. But there are other things that people sometimes want to put up. And another issue that we wanted to, that we've for a long time wanted to improve on, and that a different group presented, was clearly stating that homeowner associations can only impose reasonable rules and charges. And a third issue that our allies wanted to present was the very common sense idea that if the legislature is going to have statutes that limit homeowner association power, and there are some, then we need to have some penalties against associations that disregard, or at least against the people who disregard the rules. And so all of those issues were presented to the legislature, and all of them got hearings, but none of them were, maybe one of them was voted out of committee, but it never went anywhere. So we viewed this mostly as an educational session. We had some very good hearings. We had some very good meetings with some of the legislators. We built some connections with people who we hadn't known before. And we'll be back.
There's usually a need for doing what you're doing. There's usually a reason that you want to make some changes. And these changes are usually because something has happened. And there are stories behind there. That's one of the best ways, I think, to get your point across, is to tell these stories. This is my story. This is what happened to me. This is how it worked. This was the result. And I think once you put more of a human face on there, it seems to resonate a little better. Now, I don't know how you would go about doing that, because you can't pull everybody into the legislature, but there's got to be a way for people to tell their stories.
Well, I agree with that totally, 100%. Except that we did find a way. I'm not sure there's a disagreement, but we did find a way to have homeowners tell their stories. And we did that in two ways that are important. First, and I'll talk about several of the examples. In the issue that was not directly our issue, although certainly we supported it, on the issue of religious signs, one of the gentlemen who we had worked with, myself and also Beanie Adolf and Nancy Kazansky and the Homeowner Reform Coalition, one of the fellows we had worked with is a chaplain, he spoke in favor of his bill, and he had a very powerful presentation, which started out with the fact that he had served our country in, I think it was the Korean War. And he said, when we went to war for God and country, God first. He said, I now serve as a chaplain, I minister to people of all faiths, and many, many, many of us want to be able to express our faith in a personal way at our own home. So he described a little bit about the personal statements, both for himself and for others. I think the legislature heard him. I think that you're right that it was necessary to have the personal statements. And then what they said was, well, we'll talk about this. And the legislators expressed the fear of, how would you feel if someone put an 80-foot Buddha?
Oh, for God's sakes.
Or, for example, they said even an 80-foot cross in the house across the street from you. So when my turn came, he said, it's a religious symbol, but that's not what we're talking about. And they asked him, would you be willing to accept some limitations? And he said, sure, on the size. He just wants to be able to express himself. But when I got up, I said, look, all across the country, there are many, many places where there are no deed restrictions. And even in those places, which frequently are subject only to government regulation and therefore cannot ban religious expression because of the First Amendment, we never, ever see 80-foot Buddhas or 80-foot statues. We do occasionally see those in the countryside. There is a famous one up on the north side of, up to the north of Houston, and there are occasionally in the desert parts of Texas, somebody will put up a very large cross. But in urban and suburban neighborhoods, I said to the legislators, I challenge you to come up with even one example anywhere where someone has put up some offensive religious symbol. And nobody, of course, knew of one because, to the best of my knowledge, there aren't any. And if there are one or two, they're tiny. I mean, you know, by comparison to all the people whose religious freedom it would have been liberated by this. But we didn't object to the idea of some size limitation. It's not something I think is desirable, but we didn't object to it. And yet when the legislators went behind the scenes and negotiated, the drafts got worse and worse and worse,
yeah.
And then it never got passed. But it does illustrate, I think, the importance of individual stories. Now, for our bill on foreclosures, we did two different things. Our lead-off witness had gathered 25 examples, which he presented in a chart form, to show how foreclosures had been initiated over charges that were as little as $40 or $80. Now, they weren't all $40 or $80. Some were the immense sum of $200 or $250. None of them exceeded $500 or $600. And what he pointed out was that this was ludicrous, that a person could be forced to go to court and either risk losing their house or thousands of dollars in attorney fees over a tiny charge. So although those did not have the direct personal impact that your question, you know, that you recognize as important, we wanted to show the legislators that we had done our homework,
yeah,
and that there were a large number of people who were affected. And then we also brought individuals to testify. And we offered approximately 10 people, two of whom were lawyers, myself and someone from legal aid, because it is common that people who are lower income face this. In rich neighborhoods, they don't do this to people.
Well, yeah, they do, but maybe not as much. Maybe not as much, but they do.
Well, it's far, far less common because, in fact, the wealthy people can fight back. Whereas in the, yeah, I guess it happens some, but the much more common problem we see in the wealthier neighborhoods, at least that I see, have to do with absurd charges for or absurd refusals to approve modifications to homes. But in the low-income neighborhoods, and what we're talking about is a combination of people who either have no money or who are older, retired people or people with disabilities or veterans, and
yes,
that group of people very frequently are subject to this assault.
Right.
And so legal aid sees quite a number of these problems. So there was one lawyer from legal aid testifying on her own time, and myself, and then there were approximately 8 other people from around the state explaining the problems that they had faced. And perhaps the one that grabbed the legislators' attention the most was I'll call him a young man, but I'm going to say he's in his 30s. And he happens to be trained as a rabbi. And he pointed out that in his subdivision, although many, many people had been allowed to do many, many diverse things, the association was seeking to collect $19,000, mostly attorney fees, some for fines, based on the horrendous fact that he had, I use horrendous sarcastically, put some colors into his driveway. He used a sealant. The sealant is important for protecting the surface of the driveway, and the way the sealant is offered is that you can get a clear sealant or you can get a slightly tinted sealant, and he's an artistic fellow, and he had chosen a slightly tinted sealant. And when he showed pictures of his driveway to the legislators and said, is it fair that they should be able to come after me for $19,000? To their credit, the legislators woke up and said, no, we need to know more about this.
Yeah.
But our issue didn't get out of committee. But we did follow the philosophy that you've described, that bring some individuals who can really wake them up.
Yes.
And then also bring some version of statistics to show them that they are addressing an important problem. And what we're hoping is that there will be hearings on this issue over the we have a long intercession, a year between, you know, we have 2 years between the legislatures, and so hopefully in that year in between we'll have some hearings and then maybe get work with the relevant people to draft a bill that will do better.
Will the same legislators still be in power in 2 years' time, or will there be, will you have some elections in between and you'll have to start all over again?
In Texas, it's similar to the federal government. The senators get elected irregularly, so only a small, you know, of the 30, perhaps 10 to 15 might possibly change, depending on how many people decide not to run.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly they don't change, because mostly it's a long term gig. On the House side, they do get elected every 2 years. Again, most of the time they stay in place, and so, for example, the fellow who's the chair of the relevant committee for us, he's been in office for 30-plus years, maybe 40 years. He's not going anywhere. So it won't be a totally new crew to educate, but there may be some.
So, no, I was thinking if you were able to set up some hearings where you'd get the legislators in there and you'd get people, and that's all they did was they told their stories. And the stories are personal, it, you know, how it affected them, what happened, what they did, and all of that. That's going to resonate, because these laws are affecting real people, and here's how they're affecting them. And they're hearing it in people's own words. It's not sort of reported by a reporter or talked about by me. It's people telling their own stories and explaining how they felt and the effect it had. That, I think, would resonate a whole lot more with legislators, to the point where they might actually wake up and think, we've got to do something about this. We've let this go way too far.
Well, I agree with that, and I think that the only... there are two counterbalancing forces. One is that, of course, these hearings typically take place in the middle of the day in Austin. And although you can get people from Austin to the hearings fairly easily, Austin has a relatively smaller number, although it's increasing, a relatively smaller number of homeowner associations. We can get people relatively easily from San Antonio, and we had some, including an Air Force officer, who described his issues. And we had some people from Houston, but for people from Houston, it's 6 hours of driving.
Wow.
And then 4 hours of listening to testimony on other issues, and that's on a good day. It could be 6 to 8 hours of testimony. You know, so they, for example, in our case, they made sure that they finished our hearing by 1 o'clock before they went into session. So we only had to wait from 9 to 1. But had they not heard our bill before they went into session, they were going to reconvene at whenever session ended, which, you know, could be 6 or 8 p.m., and then take the testimony. And that is potentially quite a personal, you know, quite a commitment to request. So the better way to do it is to have a hearing. And at a hearing, they're only going to have one or two issues. You're much more likely to get a focused presentation where they're willing to listen. Although still, the legislators, they have a limited patience for hearing people. I totally agree with you that we need to bring individual stories, but the legislators often say to the people, well, we've heard that before.
Yeah.
Let's go on. And that's discouraging, but that's the nature of the legislative process, I think. And without picking sides, I can say we had some very sophisticated people engaged in the legislative process in Washington, and we see that they're all able to gum up the works, whether, you know, one way or the other, both sides of the aisle are able to do it. And unfortunately, that happens in the local legislatures as well, too.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
So it's just difficult. So we have to keep working, bringing real people out, and hopefully having some hearings on our bill.
See, what I'm trying to think of is other ways of handling this and other ways of doing it. And because I know that Julio Rabina, when he was a legislator in Florida, he actually traveled around the country and held these hearings. So that was one legislator. But the thing is, you can do this. We had people come up here from Richmond years ago when they wanted to hold stuff, but CAI made sure that none of the homeowners heard about it because they didn't want the homeowners there testifying. They just wanted their people there testifying. It leaked. We found out about it. We showed up. We testified. They were not very happy. Don't be.
So I think that one of the strategies that, and in fact, we're going to be meeting in about 3 weeks to begin developing our next strategy. Now, we've scheduled that meeting for later in August. But one of the strategies that we're going to pursue is trying to meet with individual legislators even before the legislative session.
Right.
In their home offices when it's quieter. And, you know, our issue, the good thing, one of the things we have going for us is that, first of all, it's not a partisan issue.
Yes.
We have people all the way from Bernie Sanders to Ted Cruz.
Right.
Who recognize, and we have opponents all the way from the far left to the far right. I mean, it's very discouraging that to have any opponents at all. But the good news is that we have people in Texas who cover the entire political spectrum, and it may not just be a bidirectional political perspective. We have some independents in Texas who go off in a completely different direction from either of those two polarities, who reject the Democratic-Republican paradigm and are just in a different place. We have people there as well. And they tend to have some very good connections, and so we're going to try to have some independent meetings and to develop some caucuses primarily in the big cities, which is where we can at least get more people actively involved. We've done this in the past. It's still hard because to get somebody to come in from McAllen or El Paso is to require them to get on an airplane to testify. But if they can meet with their legislator locally, it's much simpler. So in a big state, you know, and everybody defines big state for themselves, but Texas is a big state. We think we're going to have to start going more local, and we're going to be building some coalitions around a number of different issues, which will strengthen everybody's position. The good news in Texas, I think, is that we have cracked the wall that was erected by Senator Corona and his allies.
What a mess.
And they built a wall that basically said, thou shalt never question the homeowner association, the management companies, and the lawyers. And there are now legislators who are aware that something needs to be done. But there are also legislators who are very much in the pocket of Senator Corona's allies. He's still—it's still a business for him. He's just not a senator. And we need to get those allies to be willing to be quiet and let the folks who actually are representing the people come forward, and we can provide mechanisms to improve everyone's lives without hurting the ability of homeowners to prevent the construction of a gasoline station in their subdivision.
Who's going to build a gasoline station in the middle of a bunch of houses, away from the main drag, where people are never going to find it? I mean, that makes no sense. I know,
but
it's,
that's what people are afraid of.
That's what people are afraid of, red doors. You know,
I can only say to you that dealing with people's fears is difficult. Dealing with legislators is at least doable if we can get folks to get to their offices. And so for example, I talked to you, I mentioned to you, maybe this is a good time to talk about this pool case, right? We had a is it okay if we shift to that?
Absolutely.
So we have an example. I'll just explain what was going on. This is in a upper middle class subdivision north of Houston, and a new homeowner decided, they have a couple of small kids, and they wanted to put in a pool because the kids like to swim, and they put in the pool, and then they properly reported it to their insurance company, and the insurance company said, oh, you need to have a fence around your pool. Many insurance companies require it. City governments are required by Texas law to have a fence around their pool. Swim and tennis clubs are required to have fences around their pools. And the reason, in the homeowner context, of course, is that as soon as your kids learn to toddle around, that pool is a very attractive thing, and they have fun there.
Yeah.
It's a happy place. They want to go there. And so when mom and dad are in the house, momentarily distracted with maybe it's the other kid, maybe it's getting ready for dinner, maybe it's the phone rings, and for a moment they take their eyes off of the toddler, we have too many examples of toddlers running into pools and literally drowning. So this family, following the instruction of their insurance company, put up a small, inconspicuous gray fence. By small, I mean it's 4 feet high. It is not a major metal statement. It's just a mesh. The mesh is very strong. It turns out they used exactly the same mesh that my wife and I used when we had small kids for our pool in an upper middle class subdivision of Houston. And we put it in for exactly the same reason they did, which is we didn't want our kids running into the pool, and to some extent we didn't want neighbor kids running into the pool either and drowning. This is not a fence that will keep out a determined teenager. It just keeps out toddlers who can't climb up over the 4 feet. And the nice thing about this particular kind of a fence is that if you have a party, and many of us do when we have small children, you can take the fence down and you don't feel like you're swimming in a jail cell. And people can sit on the side of the pool and just enjoy it. So anyway, this family put in a fence, which was, from my perspective, a very sensible fence, because it was almost exactly what I had put in. So I thought they were right. Well, anyway, the subdivision didn't feel that way. The subdivision said, if you want to put up a fence, you have to put up an iron fence. So the family in question went to the news media. And we have a consumer reporter in town, Amy Davis. She's done a lot of excellent consumer reporting on lots of issues, and among others are homeowner association issues. She's been doing this for at least 15 years. And Amy was, this was all before I had any knowledge of this, Amy was interested, and she got her TV station to fly a helicopter over the subdivision. She, I will tell you, most of us don't have the ability to get a flyover by a helicopter. But they did. They got some video that showed several of these fences in the subdivision. I think they found 10 or 15. And so, but the Homeowners Association did not back down. And so we did a story on this. When I say we, Amy Davis did a story on this, and I had a chance to comment, and pointed out that a pool fence is simply not the same as a privacy fence. Many of us have privacy fences in Houston. They're typically wood. They're about 6 or 8 feet high, and they maintain privacy in your backyard. And this subdivision wanted iron privacy fences. So you can disagree about whether an iron privacy fence is better than a wood privacy fence. But it was pretty clear that in their deed restrictions, if you wanted to build a fence around the perimeter of your property, at least if you lived on a corner lot or near to a lake, you had to use an iron fence so people could see over the lot, for example, to the water. But a privacy fence is very different from a pool fence. It serves a completely different purpose, and it's also in a very different location. And this is an example of homeowner associations that wield power because they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I still don't know why they think it was better to put pressure on this family rather than to simply say, oh, good, you're protecting the whole neighborhood from kids running and jumping in your pool and getting hurt.
But they
so far although we think they're still considering this issue, they have not given up yet.
It would seem to me that I know that a lot of places it's a law that if you have a pool, you have to have it fenced in, because otherwise it becomes what's known as an attractive nuisance, and you're going to have everybody and everything in there.
Right, and that's generally true in Texas, although we do have the tradition in Texas, if you will, of respecting individual property rights, at least in theory. And so if you did respect individual property rights, you would allow each homeowner to make that decision for themselves. The insurers don't, because the insurers are the ones who have to pay the money if somebody gets hurt. And so they will tell you that if you want insurance, at least if you want it to cover drowning in your pool, you're going to have to put up a fence. And precisely same reason of attractive nuisance. But what bothered me was that the homeowners themselves wanted the fence once the insurance company pointed out to them that their toddlers were at significant risk. It's not something that happens once in a blue moon. It happens every summer that kids drown in their own home pools. So this is a family that, exercising their personal property right, wanted to have the fence, and it was someone else telling them, you can't do this. And that was wrong, in my opinion.
Just as an aside, just to break it up. No, I agree with everything you've said. But my in-laws lived out in the country, surrounded by farms, and they had a pool, no fence. And they woke up one day, and one of the farmer's cows got loose, and ended up in their pool. It's an attractive nuisance even for a cow. I don't know how they got it out. It was before my time. But, they didn't have a fence. So that's, you never know what you're going to find in your pool.
Although one wonders, given that it was a cow, whether they were, whether this kind of a fence will stop a toddler. it won't stop a drunk teenager, and I have no idea about a charging cow, but we'll leave that question. It is certainly true that if the cow was, it could have discouraged the cow at any event.
I don't know how it ended up there, but they woke up one morning and there was a cow in the pool, and so somehow they managed to get the cow out. But I'm assuming, because by the time I got there, there was no cow in the pool. It was gone. But no, it's ridiculous that an HOA would get all upset about something like that. If it's going to do the job, and if it's going to protect the kids, and if the insurance company accepts it as adequate, then that should pretty much be it, because I saw the picture and it doesn't look intrusive. It doesn't look like it's going to, it's not an eyesore. It looks very nice.
Okay, well, I agree with you on that.
And I just saw a picture. It didn't jump out at me and say, oh my gosh, you know, what were they thinking? But it's very nice. It was a very nice fence. It protected the pool. It did the job. And if it was good enough for the insurance company, that should be it.
Right. I mean, even if it was a little bit funky, it really is the homeowner's house. But it would be one thing if what the people said was, you know, you're building a circus-colored 8-foot-high fence that has no place in a subdivision. I might not favor it, but it is conceivable that you could have rules that called for tamer coloring. But as you point out, this particular situation was not. It was simply a gray or silver color chosen to match the house. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we talked about this legislative program. I'm not sure. We're trying to raise consciousness at the legislature about arbitrary enforcement, because in this particular case, the woman, the wife in the family, was able to contact a TV station, and because the TV station had a reporter who was already sensitive to property rights issues and their overlap with consumer protection, they were able, you know, this family was able to bring out what was essentially a very expensive big gun, although they didn't have to pay for it. But, you know, those of us who pay for advertising are paying for, you know, for the TV.
Mm-hmm.
They got the resources of the reporter and the interviews and the and people like me who will you know, give some volunteer time to a, you know, TV station to help explain the story. Most people don't have access to that. Most people would be facing, at least in Texas, substantial fines, and they don't have a way out. So we're trying to develop something that will finally appeal to the state legislators to rein in this power, which the associations really don't need. You know, I don't have a problem if the associations want to deal with something that is a public health and safety issue. And the example I usually give is if someone wants to keep a tiger in their backyard, and there are people in Texas who do. Exotic animals are popular in lots of parts of the country, but tigers in particular appeal to some people. I nonetheless could see a legitimate basis for a homeowners association to say we want to regulate or prevent the keeping of a clearly dangerous animal in a modest cage in the backyard. They sometimes get out. That could be bad. But the small number of circumstances where some kind of regulation or limit might make sense are dwarfed by the number of situations like this pool where an overactive homeowner association reins in the freedom of a homeowner.
I want to go back to the tigers. I was on the board at one time many, many moons ago. And even in those many moons ago, when I was a whole lot younger than I am now, I was in no way qualified to deal with a tiger. That's why we pay something that's known as taxes to our local municipal government, and they have animal control. This clearly is not something that the HOA should be dealing with. It's clearly something, in my opinion, that the county or the city or whoever the municipality is, they should be dealing with exotic animals.
But they don't always, and so you're on the, you're
Because we've given them a pass on that, David, because we've allowed them to shunt their responsibility over onto the private sector. But let me tell you, I'm not qualified to deal with wild tigers, and nobody that I know on any board is qualified to do that either.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, what I'm suggesting is, and you know, you can make the argument that the association should have no power whatsoever, and that any issue that is sufficiently urgent to deal with, to make a health and safety concern, is one which should be dealt with by local government. You can make that argument. I will only say to you that in my limited experience in Texas, not all local governments, in fact, fulfill their responsibility to deal with such matters, or they may choose not to have regulation. And part of that is reflects the historic personal rights in Texas, the individual liberty. And so, for example, we have in Texas a number of exotic animal farms that may be hundreds and hundreds of acres. And on those farms, they frequently raise, among other things, exotic deer and other exotic animals, and sometimes they include dangerous animals. Now, if you're talking about a 100-acre preserve, I have personally much less concern with the issue of whether the animals are potentially dangerous. I'm not saying there is no concern. I'm only saying that it's different, than being in a situation with a subdivision of hundreds of families. And so, myself, if the legislature empowered the subdivision to regulate things that are actually dangerous, or at least potentially dangerous, I would be much less opposed to such regulation. The problem is that the legislature is currently allowing homeowner associations to regulate things that aren't dangerous. And in the case of the pool, they're actually allowing the homeowner association to make a requirement that increases the danger. And that's, to me, very troubling. I agree
with you, but again, it goes back to the fact that the people who are sitting on the board are not necessarily qualified to make this determination, unlike people whose job it is to do that, or an insurance company that says, yeah, you know, this is what you need, or this is not going to hold anything back.
Well, you may be right, but I will tell you that my experience with local government is that, unfortunately, it is frequently filled with people who, although they should be qualified, are not in fact qualified. And so sometimes you look to whoever is going to be to make their best efforts. But I think that my main point is that there is a difference between allowing regulation of things that are actively dangerous and allowing things that are essentially aesthetic issues. We have also had homeowner associations that like to tell homeowners what kind of plants they can put in their front yard. Not because it's a safety issue, but because the homeowner association has some people that don't want any plants in the front yard. What they want is everybody to have two trees and grass.
Mm-hmm.
Even though in Texas, in particular, grass is often not it's not the most natural use of your property. It takes often a large amount of water, and if that's what people want to do, and if the local area has sufficient water, that's up to them. But if the people would prefer to have a what we call xeriscaped landscape, they should be allowed to. Now, we recently got a law passed in Texas that enables homeowners to have xeriscaping and that limits the ability of associations to forbid it. But unfortunately, that law still allows the homeowner associations to impose heavy regulations. And the entire premise of those regulations is an aesthetic preference for saying, for the homeowner to say, that the association to say, we don't like how it looks. And I don't think that that's reasonable. The real estate people will tell you that it makes no difference to the property values in the subdivision if somebody has a xeriscaped landscape. In fact, if you have a tolerant homeowner association, it may increase everybody's property values because you can have freedom at your own home. But the presence or absence of xeriscaping at some neighbor's house does not affect the property value of your house. That's what the real estate people all say. It's not my expertise, it's their expertise. And so we did get that bill enacted, but there's still resistance, and that's the same kind of resistance that we saw with respect to people who want to express their religious preference. And it's simply none of my neighbor's business how I express myself on my front yard, whether it's religiously or with plants or any other way.
Once you give them the opportunity to control things because they want to make sure that it's safe and it's not going to hurt anyone, they can come up with any and every excuse. You know, the plants you're using could be toxic, and if a toddler walked onto your front yard and ate it, they could get very sick. So therefore, you may not have it. The fact that I dislike that plant intensely has nothing to do with it. You do understand that, right? We're just wanting to make sure that everybody is quite safe. If you have, if you have
you're saying those words. I don't buy them, but
I've heard them.
Oh, I've heard lots of crazy things. I agree with that, but what I'm saying is that the debate, as far from the problem with the debate that we're having, is that at least at the Texas legislature, there's far too much willingness to let the homeowners association regulate the aesthetics of what I have at my house.
Yep.
And it's
not just Texas, it's all over the country.
Well, and that's a huge problem. And all I'm saying to you is that, yes, I've heard people say that it could be unsafe to have cacti in the front yard because some kid might come and prick their finger on a cactus. But from my perspective, a suitably defined statute would never allow that kind of a danger to be deemed sufficient. We've heard what I consider to be crazy arguments about bees, that the possibility that a child could be stung is enough of a reason to discourage planting colorful flowers that attract bees. That's why they say we don't want any plantings in the front yard. I mean, it's not a common argument, but I've heard it. And I think it's crazy and not supportable. And that's a piece of what we need to do is to get the legislators to implement the words that they say when they talk about individual liberty. Because they all, at least in Texas, want to talk about individual liberty, but they're not implementing that individual liberty. Now, let me say the following. There are limits on individual liberty, at least potentially. Spacing of houses is an issue of concern to many, many people. They don't want to have, essentially, apartment complexes in subdivisions. They don't want to have overcrowded subdivisions. They want to have single-family homes. That's a traditional function of zoning, and at least there's a broad consensus I might not agree with it, but there's a broad consensus that that zoning regulations that are designed to keep a single family aesthetic with the homes spaced sufficiently on lots is something that is a legitimate subject of local regulation. And in parts of Houston, which or Harris County, which have no zoning whatsoever, there's an argument at least for allowing the homeowners associations or the homeowners themselves to enforce those kinds of rules. But it might or might not be a strict issue of public safety. But what I'm expressing the biggest concern about is where the homeowner associations have the power to regulate aesthetics, often at the trivial level, powers that no government has, and even if they had it, no government would enforce, fining people for not having a net on their basketball hoop, fining people for leaving their garbage can at the curb for pickup for more than a day. These are, we're all homeowners, and the homeowner themselves is going to take steps to keep their home in as good a shape as they can, and it should not be the province of the neighbors to be saying, well, we don't think you're doing a good enough job making your home look the way we want it to look. And that's where I get the biggest objections and where I think we need to do the most education with the legislators.
Oh, I think one way to stop that is to prohibit fines by HOAs.
To prohibit which? I'm sorry?
Fines. That an HOA, a board, should not be able to fine a homeowner because...
And that's been a big dispute here, and I tend to agree with that. The fining is the biggest problem that I see with fining in a homeowners association is it's the same people that decide on the fine, decide on the amount of the fine, and that's the person you go to for to determine whether the fine should be imposed. So we have no separation of powers. There's no there's no check on completely arbitrary behavior, and that's what we frequently have with the fines. They're very commonly used as tools of oppression. And again, municipal governments do have fining power from time to time.
They do, but there's a separation of power there, and they cannot foreclose and take your house away to collect that fine. There's a huge difference, David.
Well, no, I completely agree with that. And in fact, municipal governments very rarely actually impose fines except for things like traffic speeding violations.
Right.
There are frequently on the books laws that allow fines for dangerous conditions, and even then the governments are very reluctant to impose those fines unless you get a situation where someone is essentially allowed a house to be vacant and deteriorate, to the point that it's being used for drug dealing and drug smoking. It's very rare to see fines imposed by municipal government, but it's very common for homeowner associations to use those as tools of oppression. And I mentioned earlier that in Texas we have statutory authority for things that look a lot like fines, $200 a day charges for violation of deed restrictions. Now, there have been some very recently, we've gotten some good decisions out of the courts that limit, to some extent, the ability to impose that particular fine. But they haven't eliminated it. And it's therefore a very dangerous power. If a homeowner is facing $200 a day as a fine, they may have to give up and not challenge, not assert their rights, because the economic penalty for losing is astronomical.
David, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Well, it's always my pleasure.
I hope you'll be back soon.
I hope so, too.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.